Coming up on Boston Public Radio, sometimes a handshake is just a handshake. But when Barack Obama and Raul Castro own the hands, is there more? CNN's John King on that and year-end Washington. Then the Registrar of Motor Vehicles is in studio to take your calls and to deliver some good news. Really?
Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane on the first woman ever to run a major auto company, that's GM, and I can't wait for this. Writers and their sometimes crushing self-doubt. Suppose you spent every last dime to buy a condo in a town with nice schools, then found out you couldn't send your kids to those schools. Then Vern Locke's on winter birding from Nantucket and the plight of the snowy owl. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hello there, Marjorie.
Hello there, Jim.
So thousands have attended Nelson Mandela's memorial service this morning in Johannesburg. The stadium, I'm sure you've seen it, was packed with foreign dignitaries. 100 heads of state, including former presidents George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, and President Obama, who was among a handful of leaders, to eulogize Mandela this morning.
It stirred something in me. It woke me up to my responsibilities, to others and to myself, and it set me on an improbable journey that finds me here today. And while I will always fall short of Madiba's example, he makes me want to be a better man. He speaks to what's best inside us.
Joining us on the line, as he does every Tuesday at about noon, to discuss this historic gathering in Johannesburg and other national headlines is John King. John, of course, is CNN's chief national correspondent. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon. I thought the president gave a pretty good speech there, and it was interesting. You know, when you say goodbye to leaders like this, there's often a lot of hyperbole, and you understand that, politics and the like, some mythology. But I think with a straight face, the president was able to say, here's a guy who you can compare to Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Abraham Lincoln. And you can do that with a straight face. I think that tells you a lot about the power and the legacy of Mandela.
Well, you know, John, pardon me for asking this, because it was a beautiful speech. We have been talking about Mandela as just a great leader and a man of great temperance after his 27 years in jail and how he embraced his oppressors, et cetera. But you wonder, politicians have been talking about this all week long in the United States. Is there any resonance with them? Are they going to, besides Barack Obama words, or any of our Democrats and Republicans going to be embracing each other in the kind of the spirit of Mandela, or is that just a ridiculous notion?
Yeah, wishful thinking, I guess, Marjorie. You do see, this is a hard conversation. This is a hard segue, so forgive me, anyone out there who's a student of history. This is not to insult the legacy of Nelson Mandela. You see a tiny bit of, you know, work in Washington on this budget compromise that perhaps gives you a grain of hope that, you know, some of the leaders, this is Paul Ryan on the House budget side, Senator Patty Murray on the Senate side, a Democrat, they're working out their differences, but it's a pretty modest agreement. It doesn't deal with any of the big, tough issues. It just essentially keeps us from having another government shutdown and deals with some of the, you know, funding levels for next year. However, in today's Washington, that's progress, just the fact that they've been able to meet and keep the conciliatory gestures and the actual compromise going. Can President Obama come back? Can members of this congressional delegation come back and, you know, capture some of that spirit in a bottle and bring it with them? And say, deal with immigration, say, deal with the big spending issues like Medicare and Social Security tax reform. Forgive me, but mark me down as a profound skeptic.
Well, you know, I became even more skeptical after I read about Rick Santorum, a former a presidential candidate on the Republican ticket, telling Fox News not long after Mandela died. Here's a quote from him, that Mandela, quote, was fighting against some great injustice. I would make the argument that we have a great injustice going on right now in this country with an ever-increasing size of government that is taking over and controlling people's lives, and Obamacare is front and center, essentially comparing apartheid to Obamacare. I mean, my gosh.
Yeah, try again, Senator. And again, again, there are, you know, this is not to take sides. There are legitimate questions. We've seen the president's approval ratings, you know, he's tanked. A lot of Democrats are upset about the implementation of Obamacare. A lot of Democrats or independents aren't sure what this means for them. You know, maybe they can't keep their doctor or their plan, and they thought the president promised they could. Maybe they're seeing either higher premiums or higher copays or fewer choices. This is going to sort itself out over the next couple of years. And Senator Santorum has every right. You know, he's a conservative. He has every right to question the role of government, to question the president's policies, to challenge the president's policies, and to debate them. But to compare Obamacare to apartheid, I'm sorry, just forgive me. You know, I'm not the smartest guy or the sharpest tool in the shed, but as Bill Clinton might say, that dog won't hunt.
You know, John King, I am going to be the beacon of hope in this conversation. In the half hour,
Lord knows we need one.
Marjorie and I have been in the studio for about a half hour. I've been watching two stations, mine and yours, CNN. CNN has shown, I would say, 10 times in the last 30 minutes, the what appears to be warm handshake, first ever, between Raul Castro and Barack Obama. We've all learned this morning the last time a Cuban leader shook hands with an American president was Clinton and the other Castro. Now, somebody who is taking the spirit of Mandela seriously, does Barack Obama come back and do more that's been done already? I know he's eased restrictions on some restrictions on travel and the passing of money between Cuban-American families and their families back home in Cuba. Could something come of this?
Could something come of it? Yes. But I think the question is really to Mr. Castro and his government first. Will they free Alan Gross, the American they have imprisoned there? Will they do, you know, number one, that would be a big step and a gesture to prove, okay, we want some goodwill. Here's a gesture on our part. Let's have a conversation. There are some other things they could do. But look, you know, the president had a choice there. Once Raul Castro was invited to speak, and remember, as we pay tribute to Mandela, as a great man and a great leader and a historic figure, there were a lot of differences between American presidents and Mandela because he was friends with Fidel and then Raul Castro. He was friends with Hugo Chavez. He was friends with Mugabe. He was friends with Gaddafi. He was friends with Iran. And there were a lot of differences and frictions from time to time, but they didn't get in the way of recognizing who Mandela was and an economic partnership and some other partnerships with South Africa. You might call that, you know, adult relationships. We don't have many of those, at least in the town I work in right now. So the president had a choice. Once he found out Castro, who was invited to speak, is right there, the first person he saw. You could walk by him and cause an international incident, snub him, or you could shake his hand and cause an international incident. And, you know, the president chose the conciliatory gesture because this is a memorial service for Nelson Mandela. And I think in the spirit of Mandela, you shake the guy's hand. And you don't, you know, we don't know that when the president said two or three words and then moved on, it was not a long, you know, it wasn't an embrace. It wasn't a conversation. It was a quick exchange. We don't know exactly what he said, and maybe we'll find out someday. But the White House has already said, you know, it's what you do at a gathering like this. You behave like a respectful adult, and it doesn't mean anything about the relationship with Cuba. But, you know, sometimes a week, a year or, you know, 2 years down the road, a small gesture like this does become the nugget of opportunity. And if it does, so be it.
One last thing on this Cuba connection. There's been a lot of coverage, including on CNN, of this guy from California that was held captive in North Korea for a while, a Korean War veteran, and obviously was released a couple of days ago after making one of those pathetic videos that the North Koreans required him to make about his crimes or whatever it was. This guy you mentioned a couple of minutes ago in Cuba has been held there, was it for 4 years now? Since 2009, I think?
That's about right, yeah.
Yeah, and I know his wife read a statement from him to the president saying, you're my only hope. How come this has been so backburnered when an American, a contractor, has been held captive by Cuba? Why isn't this been front and center like so many of these other things are?
The president has faced some criticism about this because it hasn't been. And a lot of the criticism has come from his own party, so the human rights activists in the Democratic Party, as well as some conservatives who just, you know, I don't, this is going to sound different than I mean it, but, you know, some conservatives who say, aha, here's a chance to, you know, to have a showdown with Cuba, who sort of relish the confrontation and who, you know, look for opportunities to say, look who these guys are 90 miles south of Florida. So there has been a lot of criticism of the president. Why don't you do more? And why haven't you used, if you won't do it directly, why don't we use intermediaries? And perhaps, you know, the issue, it, like many issues, it comes and goes in terms of the news media attention it gets because of what else is happening in the world. And maybe this will put a little bit more attention on that. And there's maybe a little pressure on the president. If you want to shake his hand, we want to see you also shake his cage a bit.
We're talking with John King, CNN's national correspondent. John, I'm just wondering, we are in the week of the anniversary of the Newtown shootings, and many of the parents have been on television. We all know a year later, virtually nothing has changed. So is any kind of gun legislation just dead? That's the wrong word to use. I don't mean to use that in this context, but you know what I'm saying. Until there's another shooting, or is it just all over, or where are we? Anything at all brewing?
No, it's just not happening. There have been some conversations about the mental health aspect, and can you find some increased funding for mental health and some increased public awareness and cooperation, maybe information sharing. Remember, a few months after Newtown, the Senator Manchin of West Virginia, Democrats, or Toomey of Pennsylvania, a Republican, two gun rights guys, Second Amendment guys, tried on the expanded background check, and they failed. They didn't have enough votes. They came up a handful short. And look, Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, has made crystal clear he's not bringing that to the floor unless he guarantees, he knows, he has the votes beforehand. The goose is cooked. And as we get closer and closer to the 2014 midterm, when we talk about Obamacare, we talk about these, you know, red state, the Democrats who are in either red or purple states like Maryland and Louisiana, Mark Begich of Alaska. I could go through the list as a Senate race in Montana. Not for a minute, Jim and Marjorie. Are the Democrats going to ask those guys to vote for gun control as we get closer to the 2014 election? It's just not going to happen.
So you mentioned a minute ago the budget deal that Patty Murray and Paul Ryan are allegedly striking, I guess, this week, maybe even announced today from what I understand. You say the results will be modest. There's no real deficit reduction. What does Ted Cruz say as to why, if his position was the first round, that he was taking a principled position to force the shutdown of government? Why is he not taking a principled position to shut down the government again?
Well, let's see what happens if they do bring this to the floor. There is some grumbling on both ends of this. The Democrats are still looking for more when it comes to extending unemployment benefits. There are still some Republicans who are talking about spending cuts, and Paul Ryan is open to having some fee increases that you know, other people will call tax increases. So I'm not sure we've heard the last from Ted Cruz on this. So this is a deal in progress. However, I think, you know, the smart people, I've not spoken to the senator directly about this. I do speak to people around him who understand the damage done to the Republican brand, and to a degree to his brand. He helped himself with a sliver of the base of the Republican Party, which is very, very important if you're going to run for president. But it's only a piece. And, you know, this politics, we make it complicated sometimes. Politics is actually pretty simple. It's about arithmetic. And, you know, you got to grow from your little number to a bigger number. And so I think he's being a bit more cautious. But let's see what happens if they put a deal to paper. And they bring it to the Senate floor. I don't think we've heard the last from Ted Cruz.
You know, on behind the scenes thing, when Ted Cruz does something like he did in the first round, and we only see the public face of this, and we hear John McCain call him a wacko bird and all these sort of things, what goes on in private? Like in a Republican caucus, when Mitch McConnell pulls everybody together before this budget thing comes up, and from what I read, McConnell, the leader of the Republicans, also has some concerns about pieces of this budget deal. Is there honest conversation to and about Cruz with Cruz, or is the understanding there's certain things you just don't say? How directly do his colleagues confront him and he them?
It depends on the moment who does it. He has been not shy about confronting people, and even people who agree with him on some of the issues, some more senior senators have said, you know, that's just not the way it works around here. The freshmen are supposed to have a little bit of due deference to the institution, if you will. However, a lot of those rules have been thrown out the window. And so, you know, if you're Ted Cruz, his answer would be, well, like Barack Obama's president of the United States. He was a freshman senator not that long ago either. You know, so forgive me, times are changing. And, you know, he can make that case. When it comes to how you conduct yourself in the Senate, as you mentioned, you know, John McCain's been in his face. Several of his other more senior colleagues, and again, some who agree with him more philosophically than John McCain, does have said, be careful. Mitch McConnell has to be careful here. There are times when Leader McConnell has private conversations with other senators when he thinks they're out of line. But remember, he's got a Tea Party challenge back home right now, a primary challenge. So he is much more likely in the current environment to either have a private conversation with Ted Cruz when he knows it's 1,000% private, or to talk to one of his people, either one of his own top aides who he trusts or one of his colleagues in the Senate. To say, look, we need to send this guy a message, and I'm not the perfect messenger to do it right now. I need you to tell him X, Y, or Z. Those back channel things happen all the time, and sometimes we learn about them after the fact, and often we don't.
We're talking with CNN's John King. John, I wonder if the same, you know, deference for freshman senators, whether to be, they should be seen and not heard, is one of the reasons why we've heard not that much lately from Elizabeth Warren. A lot of speculation about her running for president. Now she says she's not going to run for president, clearing the way for Hillary to be the girl. I mean, she was big and huge on the banking issues and federal regulation of banking, and she's been a little quiet lately.
I don't know, quiet, but let me just interrupt and say she's been pretty outspoken during this fast food strike thing.
On the strike, that's right,
during
the minimum
about
wage.
Minimum wage things and some of those
that's
issues,
right.
But I'm sorry,
that's a good
John,
point.
Go
that's
ahead.
A good point, Jim. I should have said that.
No, she's speaking. I think she's speaking out when you'd expect her to speak out, so I think you two don't disagree when it comes to – she's not – overstepping, if you will. So if it's a bank issue, she's talking. A minimum wage issue, she campaigned on income inequality, those kind of issues. She's out there. There was a bit of a liberal, conservative, internal Democratic Party spat about some funding priorities that she came out and spoke out about with a group of people. Look, I think, again, she's showing a little bit of caution. Be involved in the issues on which you have an established profile. Be careful in pushing the envelope. I will say this, that you know, I take her at her word. I don't know Senator Warren all that well. I take her at her word when she said what she said about 2016. But back in the day, you know, I have a lot of gray hair, guys. And back in the day, I spent a couple of days once back in 1991 going around the state of Arkansas with a guy who had said he would serve out his term as governor, who said, you know, hey, you people, maybe you want to let me out of that pledge because just the country needs me, don't you think? And it was, you know, it was an act. It was a great Clintonian thing. And then he said the people of Arkansas have asked him to run for president, or they're okay with him running for president because the country needs him. So I don't think Senator Warren was quite Sherman-esque. So we may revisit that one.
And you had that experience with Bill Clinton, and we all remember, you know, I guess it was in 2006, was it, when Senator Barack Obama is on with Tim Russert and says, in answer to a direct question, I'm not running. 7 months later, I am I'm thinking of running. And then a few months after that, he's a declared candidate. Let's talk about some other issue that the president said he's going to take some action on, some modest action, at least from my perspective. But let me ask you a question first. I have a strong view as to who the Time Magazine Man of the Year is tomorrow. Who do you think it is, John King?
Time Magazine Man of the Year. It won't be Koji Uehara.
That is pathetic. For those who don't know, he's the great reliever for John's Boston Red Sox.
Big, oh, my God.
Big, let me tell you who I think it's going to be in a walkover is Edward Snowden.
And,
yeah, I think that's right.
That's a good one.
And the reason I bring that up is because on one hand, we learned the other day that there are 5 billion records are being monitored a day, including, quote, incidentally is the word that was used by the NSA, some Americans' records. And then our own Senator Ed Markey has come out in the last 24 hours. He's going to file legislation saying unrelated to the NSA but related to our privacy is that these cell phone companies are giving up a ton of data to law enforcement people without warrants. And they're calling these cell tower dumps, which I'd never heard about before, where essentially they do have somebody who's under investigation, law enforcement does, but they don't just get information on their cell phone usage and whereabouts. They get cell phone data on the usage and whereabouts of everybody who has connected to that tower in recent times. Does Congress care about this, or is this still this post-9/11 mentality where whatever you got to do, no matter what rights you trample upon, that's okay with us? Where is Congress on this?
No, I think we're in the beginning of a new chapter on this, and I think we're in the very beginning, so we don't know where it's going. But you do have sort of a, hey, wait a minute. And remember, so you had 9/11, which was a horrific national tragedy, and even Bush said at the time, and I know a lot of people listening are not fans of George W. Bush, but even the Bush people said at the time, we're probably going to overreach, but better overreach than underreach in sort of the reaction we're going to take on the day after, the week after, the month after 9/11. Well, now we are, you know, what, a dozen years later, and I think the country has never taken a good pause to say, okay, you know, let's scrub this. Let's go from A to Z and scrub it. Do we still need it? Do we need to tweak it? Has it worked? Can we do it better? And remember, as this played out, I mean, think about what cell phone you had on 9/11. Think about the technological explosion, tablets and everything else, and the way we communicate exponentially more in this digital environment than we did even on 9/11, which is not all that long ago. But this technology is changing and exploding and morphing so fast that you've had this technological revolution at a time we had this, you know, security transition in the country. And I do think it's time, whether it's Ed Markey now in the Senate on the phone issue, Ron Wyden in the Senate and some others have talked about the NSA stuff, and they want to have this conversation. And some of them have had it for years, but they say they can't even talk about it publicly because they're told not to because so much of it's classified. I'm not going to defend Edward Snowden in the sense that, you know, I think he violated a work. He signed an oath. He signed a pledge. He broke some laws, most likely. And so that part of it makes you cringe. Although as a journalist and somebody who believes in transparency, I think the fact that the country now knows a lot more about how this stuff happens and how much it happens and how often it happens and how, frankly, our government has not been fully candid, even on the volume part, not the secrecy part, not, you know, what they can't tell us, not who they're spying on, some, not all sources and methods. But it's clear that they've been too cute by half and more, less than honest in telling us, you know, what they got. And so there's some good that has come of this, even though, there was probably a crime, many crimes at the root of it.
Well, you know, you can see why law enforcement can get so happy about being able to have access to everybody's cell phones. The Globe had an unbelievable story the other day about this arson in Brookline, and it talked about how they caught the suspect, not a confession, no tip or no eyewitness account. And this is a quote from the paper. It was the trove of incriminating evidence on the troubled ex-Marine's cell phone, which pinpointed his location right near the house when the fire began, and it stored messages, text messages saying he was about to make a large sum of money. He was about to do something he didn't want discovered. He hoped there was going to be no proof. I mean, the whole case was laid out right there when they got hold of the guy's cell phone record. So it's incredible what they can do now.
And so that tells you there is some investigative value to this information, and we do want the cops to solve the crimes, right?
Right.
But we don't want them to be, you know, overzealous and abusive. And so where is that middle ground? Can we agree on a middle ground? The biggest problem is I'm not sure, you know, as a society, can we agree on the middle ground?
Well, you know,
what's right and what's wrong? But we need to have the conversation, at least try.
Well, we had a sort of a conversation. I don't want to belabor this a couple of months ago, but since you talked about middle ground, I guess not everybody considered it that. There was a vote with only a 6-vote turnaround margin where every member of the Massachusetts delegation, except for Joe Kennedy, voted to restrict the so-called snooping powers of the NSA in general. It was a broad vote, except in those cases where an individual is actually under investigation, sort of the traditional basis for getting a warrant or checking into someone's personal records and that sort of thing. Why is that not a perfect place for liberal Democrats and small government Republicans to meet? And again, it lost 217 to 205, I think. Isn't that a perfect middle ground for those kind of people?
And I think that vote tells you that it likely will be something around that. And those people say they'll try again. And some of the people who voted no say they want to have the conversation to try to, either study the issue more or to just tweak what those people who were trying to have the new restrictions wanted to do. So I do think that is the sign that bill failed. But you can view it as, oh, it failed, it's gone. Or you can view it as, oh, they came really close. And so we can keep that conversation going. And I think that, again, is the conversation the country has to have. After 9/11, you know, they threw these giant nets into the water, and they wanted to pull every fish out to find out who was the bad fish. Now it's probably time to think about, shouldn't we shrink the net a little bit? Shouldn't we shrink the government's authority a little bit and just go looking, you know, go looking in the places where we're pretty sure the bad fish are instead of grabbing everything? But, you know, it is hard because it's so sensitive. It is hard because there are people in the government who are, you know, good public servants who say, hey, we crack a lot of cases because of this. We keep a lot of people alive because of this. So to the degree you can in public, you have to have this conversation. And then the people who have classified clearance in the Congress on the Intelligence Committee need to sit down in private and work some of this stuff, too.
Make me happy. Now, John King, we don't want to deprive you. You spoke a second ago of something having been close. I assume you're glued to your television set, as we know you are, this past Sunday at 1 o'clock when an onside kick may have changed history. So was that uplifting, or were you so depressed about Gronkowski that you couldn't even enjoy the 21-point victory? What was it?
No, you still got to win the game, but I am depressed about Gronk.
Listen to him.
I think that's just a hard lead. But I just love the kicker. I love that usually they kick it to one side. The kicker kicks it straight ahead and essentially blocks the ball and runs in front of it. So that was, to me, that was awesome. I just think, you know, I just never seen a kicker take the hit for that. You know, he could have got his head taken off.
Hey.
To block the pass of the ball. But the Gronkowski loss is going to hurt as we move forward into the into the playoffs.
You've heard John King say awesome before,
by the
way.
John, you got to read Dan Shaughnessy's column today in the Boston Globe, where he does a fantasy thing about how the Patriots come back from a 93-0 halftime deficit
against
the
Seattle
Super Bowl.
It's a riot.
They come back and they win. Maybe you'll get a kick out of it.
Maybe Big Poppy and Koji can play tight end.
Oh,
I don't know, you know?
Goodbye. John King from CNN. We'll talk to you next Tuesday. John, thanks so much for your time.
Okay. Thank you, John. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent, and he joins us every Tuesday. I love to talk to him. John, it's always great to hear from you. Okay. Time for you to take a number and get in line, because the Registrar of Motor Vehicles is here to take your questions and ours. Up next, Rachel Caprillion on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This week, WGBH News has a week of focus coverage on the search for Alzheimer's treatments.
If we don't come up with something, our whole healthcare system is going to get bankrupted by this disease. And people that understand that realize that this is panic mode we're in right now. It's panic mode.
I'm reporter Sean Corcoran. Join us for Desperate for a Cure, focus coverage on the search for new Alzheimer's treatments. All this week on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Harvard Extension School, International Development of Sustainable Economies. Registration for 3-week January course through December 19th. More information at extension.harvard.edu. And Christmas City at Seasons 4, featuring a large selection of fresh and artificial trees and wreaths, plus gifts and holiday decorations including ribbons, lights, and ornaments. Open every day on Mass Ave in Lexington. Seasons4.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And so, have you lost your driver's license? Do you need to renew it or your registration? Can you pay citation fees online? Here to take those questions and more is our guest, Rachel Caprillion. Rachel, of course, is the Registrar of Motor Vehicles from Massachusetts. Rachel Caprillion, great to see you again.
Great to see you. It's great to be here.
Thank you for being here, Rachel. So before we begin, by the way, people can call in at 877-301-8970 if you have questions, 877-301-8970.
You can yell at her, too, by the way. She is really good
she's
at
tough.
Taking
she's
criticism.
Tough. I'm
you can
sure
do whatever
you
want. You can
yell that many times before.
Thank you.
You can also
You're
email
welcome.
At WGBH. Oh, geez.
I'm not
the
telling
email?
You. You figure it out.
BPR at WGBHnews.org.
Very good,
Very
Marjorie.
Good.
Thank
I got
you.
It. Okay. So you have a big surprise, though, for people. How
Recent
do you do
surprise.
With their birthdays?
Yes.
So tell us about this, please.
Big smile on Rachel Caprillion's face.
Yes, there is indeed. Yes, this is a big surprise, and this is what everyone pines and wishes for, a birthday card from the Registry of Motor Vehicles.
That's right.
So, yes, we have reinstituted our license reminder service since I was the registrar at the time and take full accountability for all my decisions in a period of very tough budget cutting. I had to cut about, $12 million out of my budget. And one of the things that sort of went that way of what I consider to be non-front line was the license reminder. What we've learned in 5 years, you can never be afraid to listen to what people say. You can never be afraid to reverse course. So over these years, I heard over and over that people did like the reminder, some of whom depended on the reminder. It is important. It is in the state's best interest to have people who are driving on valid licenses. So we want to help people remember. And part of that helping them to remember is to send them a birthday card, because the license, of course, expires on what? Your birthday. Once every 5 years. So it is a simple postcard that says happy birthday from the Registry of Motor Vehicles within 30 days, the month that you have your birthday. Your license is about to expire. And even better, smarter technology has given us the ability to say, Marjorie Egan, you can renew online. Or Marjorie
Love
Egan,
that.
You can't renew
Love
online.
That.
You have to go to a branch. Go to massrmv.com and find out where the branches are if you have to. And if you don't, stop what you're doing. Get on your computer. Renew online if you can do so.
Well, you know what? One of the best things about having to only get your picture taken for every 10 years is once you get a little bit beyond 35 and 40, you have the same picture for 10 years.
I hear you screaming.
Yeah,
I understand entirely.
Yeah, I have to go back and get a new picture taken. This time I'm distraught.
By the way, Amanda very politely has told us that it's BPRWGBH.
org.
Oh, what did
no
I say?
News in there. It's okay. You were close. And
I'm
close.
Sorry.
Is good
enough. Okay.
Hey,
thank you, Amanda.
Rachel Kaplan, I know there was a budget crisis, and now you're dealing with that. Did I read somewhere that part of this is being offset by either sponsorship or some? How are you paying for this?
Indeed,
thing?
You did. First of all, we're sending a postcard. A postcard is cheaper to send than what we used to send, which was a letter. There's no identifying information. If it, you know, you get your postcard, it doesn't have any information other than the recipient on that is going to have a birthday coming up. Not when, not anything else. The other thing is on this postcard, on the flip side, is an advertisement. So there'll be an advertisement that is paid for by the advertiser, just so all those eyeballs will take a look at who's on the postcard. So we are now doing it for a fraction of the cost of what it used to cost. And it's just, it's a great service. And our hope is that people will, this will be the kick they need to be reminded.
Yeah, well, I hate that, by the way. However, I'm softening over the years. I hate the corporate naming thing of subway stations or whatever we've talked about. But I assume you say that there are certain corporate sponsors who are kosher and certain
yes.
who are not. How do you decide who can advertise on this card and who can't?
It's not an industry that we would regulate, and it's all within the rules and regulations of MassDOT. And that said, it's like we really do a lot, particularly on our website where we're also doing advertising. A lot of people look at it, and if you're an advertiser and you want a lot of people to be looking at your message, I mean, it's not a bad gig. And we in government have to really think creatively and how can we do some of the same services and customer service, but do it for less cost. And some of that is leveraging, you know, private industry.
Are you the longest? You know, I was thinking about you today. Well, I obviously was thinking about you since you were coming. Are you the longest serving registrar ever?
Not ever, but in modern days, I'm coming up there.
What, you've been with it the whole time Deval Patrick has been governor, right?
Not in the entire time. I've been here for 5.5 years. Oh. And Gerald Nazo was there longer in
Who?
The early 90s.
Wow.
Gerald Nazo.
Don't remember
he
him.
He served
was
with
that a
Weld and
pick?
Salucci. Yes, but he crossed over. He made the turn.
You know, I have one other question, and then we'll start taking our calls. I saw a little scufflaw showed me this, a fake ID that looked so much like a Massachusetts driver's license. I was, like, stunned. And I wondered, if you're like a bar, if you run a restaurant or a bar or something, is there some way to tell what a real license is versus a fake license? I mean, they're laminated. They look just like real licenses.
Well, I'd like to get a look at this license because one of the things I meet weekly with the state police, and we have not yet seen a good copy. I haven't seen it, a good copy of a fake Massachusetts license. There's plenty of fake licenses. They usually work with states that are easier to duplicate.
Yep.
Our license has many different security features. We have a hologram. We have a ghost image. We have a perforation that you can only see under that, you know, light that bouncers have.
Wow.
It is very, very hard to copy our license. It is considered to be the most secure in North America and maybe the world. I mean,
wow.
Every generation is, you know, kind of gets a little bit more secure. But in terms of other states, when I go to, you know, some of our trade conferences, we are way ahead of most other states in terms
of our
security.
So it's a naked eye thing, as in your case, versus what some people would check before they would authorize someone to go have a drink or something like that. So 5.5 years, I want to get back to this 5.5 year thing. Mm-hmm. Well, other than having dealt with a budget crisis and then coming out of it to a great, what's the most frustrating thing you have to deal with, Rachel Kaplan?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say it's frustrating. I think that it was frustrating when you can't meet customer expectations. And for me, that's about wait times, whether it's wait times at the branches, whether it's wait time in the call center. I mean, obviously, this is an austere time in government, and nowhere are you more directly affected in terms of customer service than at the registry of motor vehicles. And people interact with us in a whole host of ways. So we're trying to communicate to the public how much you can really do online. Your grandfather's way of going to a branch really is going the way of the dinosaur, thank goodness. And as soon as we have our upgrade in our computer system, we'll be able to do even more transactions online, and there'll be more intersections that people are used to doing, like whether it be mobile technology, whether it be at a kiosk. The things that people are doing now in other parts of their lives, we want them to be able to do. We want to give them a MyRMV account. Like I just was on my Amazon account trying to buy Christmas presents, so I looked at, you know, the things that I looked at. So on my RMV account, I'll be able to see everything I've ever done, when things are due, how much I'm going to have to pay for my registration, whatever the case may be. It'll all be there, personalized to me.
So you're going to have drones drop your driver's license. So
I should bring that up with the union if they allow drones.
What percentage of transactions are currently done online?
It depends on the type of transaction. In registrations, for example, almost 70 plus percent of all registration renewals are done through what I call non-branch means. It's done online. Most of them are done online through the mail, because when we mail it to you, you can just put it in an envelope, mail it back, or over our phone. We have a phone tree that you can just renew your registration, you know, press, you know, this button. So we are getting there. Licenses is one of the frustrating things is that when I see someone in a branch who could have renewed online, particularly their license, and they didn't know that. So I'd say with license, we have a little bit of way to go. About 50% of the time at any given time, a person is eligible to renew online. And of the ones who are and don't, it's about a third. So
one last thing before we get to the calls. When you mentioned the frustration is you don't want people, those who do go to actual locations, to have to wait, you know, an inordinate amount of time. I can't remember because I was at Watertown recently.
Yeah.
I had a long line, but people were incredibly helpful and respectful.
Country Buffet.
Let's not even have that conversation.
They have good pudding there, though.
That's not your fault.
If you like pudding, it's good.
do you not have a thing that says how long your estimated wait is, or am I wrong?
We do. And sometimes when we get really overrun, it's harder to predict because you'll just have longer, more complicated transactions that kind of plug up the queue. It's not terribly scientific, and you got to be, you know, constantly reevaluating who's in your branch, what they're waiting there for. Watertown is tough because the volume is intense, and there's a lot of people there for, you know, out-of-state conversion licenses disproportionately to other branches in the state. It's the second busiest branch in the state. So there's a lot of just generalized problems that are, you know, particularly endemic to
Rachel,
Watertown.
My lovely
hometown, I might add.
We know that. And Rachel, of course, always calls me for advice about how to run the registry. Do you not do that?
Every week.
Okay, I'm going to give you advice
anyway. He knows better than you. I just want you to know
because I spent
Rachel.
A lot of time there. I know you know this, but I have to say, there's nothing I hate worse than a long line. I mean, there's nothing. However, and this is a huge however, when your people have a smile on their face and come up to you if you're in a long line and try to be helpful, it's sort of like an apology in public life. We talk about apologies a lot on the show how it causes people to melt. And you have a lot of those people, I should say, at Watertown.
It really
changes the dynamic and the tension and the stress. And so that's huge. I mean, it doesn't cut the wait time, but it does make you feel like you're not being considered some slug who's just got to wait in a long line. So, frankly,
I will pass that along. And they are lovely, lovely people.
They really are really good
to the customers. And they leave the customer better than they found them. And believe me, they're not always treated like with a great deal of love by the customer. Okay. And I understand that, too, because, you know, I don't want customers waiting for long periods of time. And, you know,
what just occurred to me? Do you still have the deal? We complained about this on the radio ages ago. I don't know if you were the registrar at this time. No, you couldn't. Well, maybe you were. Because when Mitt Romney was running for president, I don't know why this just popped into my head.
What?
There was a story in the Boston Globe or the Herald about how there's some sort of VIP deal
if
you're a big deal.
About.
And he didn't have to. And if you're running for president, I think you probably shouldn't have to wait in line in Watertown. But is there still a VIP thing if you're someone of some stature?
No. We have and we do have one segment that can do what's called an instant issue. And usually it is really through the registrar's office. And it is really up to the registrar's office discretion whether or not you're going to allow it. In Mitt Romney's case, yes, he did go to the instant issue part of the registry because he had Secret Service with him. He won the nomination. I don't want Secret Service, you know, going into any of the branches and making things, you know, uneasy for the other customers.
Wise decision. Let's go to the phones.
Debbie,
she is the registrar of motor vehicles. Her name is Rachel Caprillion. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
The name of the caller is Debbie from Upton. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Okay. I would love to participate in this love fest with Rachel Caprillion, who sounds fabulous, by the way. I listen to you all the time.
Well, thank you.
Oh, my God. Owning a car in Massachusetts is like being at war.
Wow. Those are big. Those are
take it away,
words,
Debbie.
Debbie.
Let's hear it.
Really, I am not on the winning side. Really. And you know what? I really admire everything that you're doing to make it more efficient. And I was in Watertown last week, and the line did go quickly. Anyway, before I go off on a tangent, all right, so I have two questions related to if you get stopped for drunk driving. Yep. And this happened to a friend of mine, and they're embedded in a story, and I'll make it quick, okay?
Okay.
So No, and I won't mention the thing about me getting a ticket in Boston because when I renewed my registration online, I didn't get that little orange sticker that goes in the back of your plate.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So guess what? $40 ticket, and I had a valid registration, but
the decal. Yeah.
What about the drunk driving?
I'm glad,
Debbie, right?
I'm glad you're not mentioning the decal. That was good you didn't bring that up. Go ahead, Debbie.
I want to bring that up. Let me just get to the drunk driving, which wasn't drunk driving, but in any case. So my friend has stopped. He's coming from some friend's house. The police stop him. Have you been drinking? I've had two beers, officers. Okay, get out of the car. He gets out of the car. He walks the line. Take a breathalyzer. And my friend declines to take a breathalyzer.
Yep.
So my first question is, given that then, am I correct? He tells me that his license is automatically suspended when
correct.
He declines.
Correct, yes. Statutory. Correct. That is from Melanie's law.
As it
law.
Should be.
That was Melanie's law.
The great Ron Bersani, grandfather of Melanie Powell, responsible. But go ahead, and the legislature. Go
okay.
ahead, Debbie.
All right, as it should be. So this person who at the moment is innocent of anything and has waiting 2 months without a license, the guy's got no job, and blah, 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 has to pay for a lawyer, gets to court 2 months later, and I honestly can't remember whether he was either found not guilty or the officer didn't show up. But in any case, the whole thing was dismissed.
Okay.
Then he tells me, and this is the part I can't believe, that in order to get his license back, the license was suspended, even though he was found not to have been guilty of anything, he has to pay $500. Is that correct?
For the reinstatement fee? Honestly, I would have to look at that individualized record, but generally if you've been suspended on an OUI, reinstatement is $500. Let me look into that case specifically if you want to leave your name.
Debbie, stay
with
on
the
hold.
Producer, I'll be happy to
wait
look
a minute,
into
wait
it.
A minute. Wait a minute. But suspended on an OUI, even if it's determined not to be an OUI?
I need to look
saying.
At the disposition of the court.
He also didn't take the breathalyzer. That's a big problem.
Debbie, stay on hold. One of our producers will take your number.
That's a suspension. That's not a revocation. So some of it is like, what's the timing of it? What else was on the record? It's like anything with a suspension, I call it the snowflake ones because there are no two that are the same. I mean, there are no two suspensions that are the same.
Well, you get personal attention, Debbie. So again, leave
yes,
the info
will.
And you'll hear from Rachel Caprillion's office. Thanks for the call.
Lisa from Attleboro. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, thanks. You're on with Rachel Caprillion.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
I've had a lot of interactions with the registry lately because of car issues, mm-hmm. and I cannot comprehend why I can go to Attleboro for my daughter to get a learner's permit. There's nobody in the place. It's empty.
It's quiet branch. You're right. It is true. It is one of our
fabulous.
Quiet places. Fabulous. Okay,
and
that's nice.
Then I went to Taunton to get a new registration. 2 hours. Can't they do some of this in Attleboro? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, well, you can do new plates. Yeah, okay.
Well, new plates. I need a new registration because my son just totaled my third car.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Well, that's not,
okay, Lisa,
you know,
let's have Rachel Caprillion respond to the first thing, if
first
we can.
First of all, I'm sorry your son is doing that to your cars, but we, the registry, are we're sorry for that. But the Attleboro branch, you're right, it is a very efficient branch. It's not a totally full service branch. Taunton is a place that is particularly stressed right now in terms of staffing and levels. We are going to be changing that around. We have some new replenishments that are coming in, hopefully the end of this month, and you're going to see an immediate change in Taunton. Taunton is like I have every at any given time, there's like a handful of branches that are sort of, you know, the biggest problems right now. Taunton is in that group.
Hey, Lisa, thank you for the call. You know what's interesting? You know this 10 times better than we do, Rachel. As a former state rep, also, I don't care what issue we talk about that has an emotional content. We could talk about immigration reform, mm-hmm. the Affordable Care Act. There is nothing that generates passion in the voice like an issue with the registry. I don't know how you deal with this. You seem to be totally calm and relaxed. Are you or you're not?
I mean,
it's
not a facade. I appreciate that everybody has, when you come to the registry, it isn't like you get up in the morning and you're like, I can't wait
to go.
I mean, you have an issue, you need it resolved. And my goal is to try to resolve the easily resolvable as quickly as possible and try to handle the harder to resolve, as efficiently, as fairly, as kindly, as respectfully as possible. I mean, I want people's responses to the registry to be that of like, got it done once, and I don't have to deal with this again for a number of years.
By the way, Amanda has a little tip. She says that people think that the smart thing to do is go early in the morning to the registry, but in fact, she said that's a terrible idea. What you want to do is go right before closing time because everybody will hurry up to get you out of there so they can go home.
Well, it's also, we are generally slower after about 3 o'clock in general. I mean, when people have a problem, they want to go solve it. So that's one of the reasons we're so busy in the morning. People want to get it done out of the gate. Lots of times, they don't know how big a deal this is going to be. So we are definitely busier in the morning. And it's inverse. Like people are saying to me like, oh, it must be quieter around Christmas. No, no, no. We get busier than ever.
Why?
Around
because people
Christmas.
Have time off? Is that
people
why?
People have time off. They're buying new cars for their, you know, their new wife. They're taking permit tests because they want to just get some driving hours in. They have a commercial registration that expires at the end of the year, and they're a small business, and it takes a long time to come up with all the money for all your trucks. Different reasons, but it creates a lot of busyness.
Yeah, before we get back to the calls, Rachel Caprillion, the Registrar of Motor Vehicles, one question about the expansion of online possibilities that you talked about with some enthusiasm. Is there a direct connection between greater online use of the registry's things and a diminution in wait time, or is the online allow you to deal with budget cuts better, meaning in terms of person power? You understand
what
I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying. It's both. We are able, like, let's give it to you this way. More than 10 years ago, the registry had about 1,100 employees, or at least more than 1,000 employees, and the budget was about $70 million. Now, you know, all these years later, with inflation, our budget is $63 million, and we have less than 800 employees. The delta is online. How many agencies of my size have that much of a smaller budget, that many fewer employees, more drivers, more registrations?
You know, I don't get
the
about
delta
this.
Delta is the internet.
You are thinking about it in a sort of an even-handed, I don't know, black and white sort of way. I say, and again, you as a former state rep can probably relate to this. It seems to me that state reps and state senators care much more about things like the registry than they do the big issues, because the registry is the thing that every one of their constituents is going to call, yell at them about.
Yeah.
So how do you explain, as somebody who used to live through the budget process on the other end, how do you explain the fact that they have allowed this to be one of the places that's taken the brunt of budget cuts through?
Well, I guess everybody gets it. And when there's budget cuts across the board, I mean, you know, having been a state rep, I mean, I'm very concerned. I'm more concerned, frankly, about a child being in an abusive
home,
not
obviously
being investigated, than if I have to wait 5 more minutes at the registry. So these are a tough balancing act for my former colleagues, and I appreciate that. Now, I generally hear more from them as if our wait times are heavier. I'll hear more from them when we have high seasons, like around Christmas time or during the like height of the summer or April vacation, which is like my nightmare. It's like a Fellini nightmare.
So wait a minute. Hold on. So we shouldn't go Christmas vacation, April vacation, February vacation. Is that out?
February vacation is not as bad.
Not as bad.
But April vacation is like permit city.
Okay.
It's
and summertime
crazy.
In July, August, are they both about
We're very
the
busy in the summer, but the further you get closer to Labor Day, the crazier it gets.
Okay.
Okay. Let's go back to the calls.
Bob, yes, good tips.
You're in Westford, and you are next with Rachel Caprillion, the Registrar of Motor Vehicles in Massachusetts. Hey there, Bob.
Good afternoon, Jim, Marjorie, and Madam Registrar. How are you?
I'm great. Hi,
Bob.
I have a very quick question. First, I want to applaud all of your great efforts. I use the Lowell branch of the registry, and the staff there are tremendous, and they have to deal with a polylingual customer base, and they do a tremendous job. I want to applaud your efforts there.
Well, thank you. I'll pass that along to that group.
My question is more selfishly oriented. You were talking about you're not my grandfather's registry anymore, and my question is about special plate numbers.
Okay.
A lot of folks in the Commonwealth have 4-digit plate numbers and 5-digit plate numbers, and they keep them in the family, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean.
And I have a close relative that has a 6-digit plate that's all the same number, which is in a very exclusive club.
Yeah,
and
reserve,
they want to maintain that, but they have the green number plate and they have to upgrade it to a red number plate. And they've been told that it's no longer available to them after having it for over 50 years. Suggestions as how to renew that plate so they can keep it?
I mean, I don't have a good feeling about that plate since it's a green plate. We do have green plates that are reserve plates. We do have green plates that are vanity plates. Those can be renewed in red.
What does reserve plate mean?
It's as he described. It's sort of, for lack of a better term, it's like a legacy. I mean, it goes back, I don't know how many registrars ago, but it is true that if you have one of those low number plates, it's passed down from father to son to daughter to. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I did as a registrar is that, you know, it's important to recognize there are other familiar relationships that are not as we used to describe them.
Hmm.
So we've updated as we've gone along. If you could leave your name with the producer, I'll make sure that I look at that specific plate. But my suspicion is that it might just be one of those plates that, you know, really law enforcement doesn't like plates that are all the same number. And it's probably an old green general issue plate that happened to have all the same numbers that we may not be able to renew. So I will check it out. I will check it out and see how it's classified.
Bob, don't go away. way, stay on hold. One of our producers will take your info.
You know, this is something I don't understand. I understand why people like to get fancy cars and drive around with them and stuff. I don't get people's obsession with plates. We have an email about the Karen Pulido Red Sox plates that the Globe has written about. She, of course, is running for lieutenant governor. And this gentleman with it. What is this? People like to get their parents' plates?
I can't answer that. It's unanswerable. It's one of those things that people, I don't know, why do people collect owls? Like, why do people collect Hummels?
Who collects owls?
That actually is a real
example. Who collects owls? Who came in my store in Provincetown? I've told you the story 400 times.
Your store in Provincetown?
My store in Provincetown.
It was a leather merchant.
Decades ago. It's a long story. Who came in and asked if we had any owl products because she collects them? Lauren Hutton. I've told you this story.
That's right.
So that's the answer to your question. You know, speaking of that, so there's no answer to the question. Yeah. Here's an
people
answer.
People like it. It's a thing. I don't know why people like plates. They find them interesting. In some cases, it's like a status symbol. If it's a low enough number, it means you knew someone high up 50, 60 years ago.
Well, I've heard you on Dan Ray doing this thing, this auction. Oh my God. I mean, but in any case, putting this aside
auction
for a second.
What? Low number plates?
Yeah, low number
it's
plates.
A lottery. It's not an auction.
Excuse me.
It's a lottery. And there are people who literally, they think of how many relatives they can get to, you know, to because it's open to everybody if you're over the age of 18.
Okay, so another thing is when people, I have a right whale plate. I know I'll be ridiculed for that, but I do. It is what it is. When people decide that they want to have one of those, are they called specialty plates?
Yeah, special plates, charity plates.
And what do they do? They collect a certain number of signatures? How does that work if you want to do something?
Well, it used to work that you could petition the legislature. And what the registry found out at that time is that, like, I'll give you an example, like the Blackstone Valley plate, not wildly popular. So it cost the registry more to make that plate than we ended up losing money on just to make the
poor
plates.
Blackstone Valley.
Well, I mean, I think I'm glad I'm giving them a pitch because it's lovely in the Blackstone Valley. And those of you who live out there and love it should get a plate. But anyway, I love them all the same. I love all the specialty plates the same.
The Blackstone Valley?
It's sort of Worcester and all that sort of thing.
But
right?
At some point, there became like a registry regulation that to prove you will have enough people interested in getting this plate so that it will really appropriately benefit the charity, you have to prove that 3,000 people will sign up for it, or 1,500 if you have someone willing enough to post a $100,000 bond.
So 3,000 who have committed
given a check.
If the plate is issued, they will buy that plate.
And that's right.
Well, let me one last question.
What about the Red Sox plates?
Plates were done by legislation. That said, the Celtics, they have a plate that they got 3,000 people to sign up for.
One last question about these, then we'll take a couple of more quick calls, is I saw for the first time today, maybe it's been around and I haven't been attentive, there was a pro-life license plate. I don't know if it says pro-life on it or something. And this is, by the way, I'm not taking a position on the plate being issued, so don't get your dander up out there. Can you make a political statement if I say
it's a charity.
I want to raise the income tax and I'm creating a nonprofit, a 501c3, to educate the public about raising the income tax? If I got 3,000 people who wanted a raise the income tax plate,
walk through Cambridge, you could find that.
Well,
Deval
Patrick and I would be too.
Can you do that?
Yes, you can, as long as it is a legitimate 501c3 that
nonprofit.
Is authorized a nonprofit by the Secretary of State's office in Massachusetts. Yes, it is a charity. It is no. We don't look at it as a political statement. We look at it as, is there a legitimate charity, and we do not opine on whether we like it or not.
Okay. And do you still have the one woman who is in the Globe every couple of years whose job it is to ensure that people aren't cleverly getting some obscene thing on their license plate?
Does she still exist?
Right?
She does
one
exist.
Of the great jobs
she
of
does,
all time.
She does exist, and every now and again there'll be someone. I'll see one every now and again.
Uh-huh.
It is wildly entertaining.
Like what?
I can't say it on.
Well,
me.
Obviously. Oh.
But they get cute. Sometimes it's like what something looks like in the
rearview
mirror,
of course.
So you really got to think about, and I can, the registrar can pull it off the road, like if it slips by. And things have slipped by. And every now and again, someone will text me a picture of a plate.
That's
and say,
great.
How'd this
I
get by
this.
You? And one of them was New Hampshire, so that's an issue they have to take up with New Hampshire.
Let's squeeze another one or two in for Rachel Caprillion, the registrar of Motor Vehicles in Massachusetts. Bob, you're in the car. You're on with Rachel Caprillion. Hi.
Thanks very much for putting me on.
Pleasure.
And great show. I always enjoy it.
Thank you.
And good luck to Ms. Caprillion with her job. Tough job.
Thank you. It's a great job. This is a great job.
I think she actually does love it. Go ahead,
I
Bob.
I do.
We can sense her excitement with it. But this past summer, my wife was re-registering her car, and we attempted to do it online. That subsequently didn't work out, but she ended up on a link that purported to help her, and we subsequently got on our charge card $14.99 bill.
Yeah.
So something that really didn't help very much.
Yeah, I know where this is going.
Kind of sounded like a scam. I'd be interested in your reaction to that.
It was a scam, without a doubt, and that's one of the things we're trying to communicate to the public more and more. We're seeing more mimic sites that say massdmv.com. We are not the DMV. We're the only one in the country that is the RMV, the Registry of Motor Vehicles. So when you do a Google search, I'm told, I don't know if all...
I've done it, and I've had the exact same problem this gentleman has said.
And it comes up. Anytime you see a figure with a, like $14.99, or, you know, you can go on our mass.gov if you want to, like, go through that way. You see a picture of the governor, and you can link on to the RMV that way. We are massrmv.com.
So
that is our website.
But, Rachel, if people don't remember what the website is, like, and I have this problem all the time,
yes,
and I don't have the document in front of me, and you Google it, how do you know what's real and what's the scam?
The best advice we can give people is just look for signs. Like, if it's a DMV, it's not us. If you get any change that it wasn't, like, a figure, like, 50, or it says 99 cents or 75 cents, not us. You can always, if you really are questioning this, it looks kind of funny, and I don't recognize that state seal. That doesn't look like the Massachusetts state seal. Assume that it is a mimic site. We're working with Google on the search engine, too, so that we come up first.
You know, the perfect solution, when you said, I think you were serious when you started this discussion with us a half hour ago, this My RMV thing is your goal, where people have individual accounts. I mean, ultimately, if you have an individual account and you bookmark it, you're never going to have an issue.
I'm so glad you said that. I'm going to say that from now on, every single radio station.
Thank you.
Entirely right. That is a good way to do it.
When you
have your own account.
Because he knows how to run the Registry of Motor Vehicles. He has no doubt about it.
Or he buys a lot of stuff on Amazon, because I always just have to go to my own account. It's a lot easier.
I was Deval Patrick's second choice, I'm told. Oh. In any case.
I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that.
Incidentally, we're not going to get to all the calls. We're going to take one more. And if you're on hold, don't be frustrated. If you're on hold and we don't get to you, if you leave your number with the producer before you hang up, Rachel's office will be in touch. And we'll forward the emails, too. That's okay with you, correct?
It is okay. And I'll say this about the callers. We usually can answer questions relatively easily. And we don't want it. We can go to our website. A lot of the FAQs, and there's a lot of information on there that might answer your question anyway.
So let's take one last one. And again, the rest of you, please stay on hold, and we'll make sure that you are in touch with Rachel's office. Maureen, you're in Boston. You're on with Rachel Caprillion. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi.
My question revolves around having a state ID which replaces the driver's license when you no longer drive.
Yep.
And you can't live without it. You can't open a savings account of $100 without a state ID now under Homeland Security.
Well, you need an official, like, sanctioned ID. Yes, correct.
Right, which is, in Massachusetts, the state ID, I've been told.
Yeah,
because
it depends on the entity. Yeah, but sometimes
I've obtained it.
Okay.
You go to the registry, and you wait, and you get your picture taken, or they just renew it every 5 years.
Yep.
$25, no age limit, disability disregarded. You must have it, and I'm wondering if there's any cutoff point. Do 95-year-olds continue to have to go?
Sure. I mean, as long as you need state ID. I mean, we have, you know, licensed drivers who are 95 and who are driving, you know, correctly. So it's like there's some...
But this is, if you're not... I'm trying to be practical.
Yeah, no...
Because it's happened to me, and I've become more and more disabled.
Yes.
And it seems stunning to have to take the ride to go to a registry office and then pay $25 to have the same picture put on the new card, just with the card updated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can appreciate that, but people do, their images change after a certain number of years, and those are sort of federal requirements that we have to make sure we get updated images and make sure we have it updated, you know, information on that individual. So there's state interest in doing that. That's my only response I can give to you.
Couldn't they
sometimes do
that online, too, I would think? Can't you? Or maybe you can't.
If you don't need a new picture, you can renew online.
Okay.
Hey, before you go away, Rachel Caprillion, again, all of the calls, all the emails will be forwarded to her office. Is there anything we didn't touch on that's new that matters to people that you should share, or no?
Just that we're getting busy, and you know, this is a very busy time, and I would just advise the public to try to massrmv.com for any and all of your registry transactions before you go to a branch. If you need to go to a branch and you must, then try to not to go on a Monday or a Friday. And try not to go during the lunch hour, because that's just always, everyone likes to go in the lunch hour. And guess what? our staff people take lunch, so we're not fully staffed.
Now, let me just say one last thing that I think is an ethical person. I've known you for a long, long time, Rachel. When you do mention on other radio or television shows this My RMV thing will solve the problem, I would suggest, in the spirit of whatever, you would say, as suggested by Jim Browdy of WGBH.
Without a doubt. I footnote
radio.
Everything. All the suggestions, I footnote everything.
Fine. It's the least I can
Jim Browdy.
Rachel Cabrillion, she is the registrar. Rachel, it's great to see you. Thanks
Thank
so much
you.
For
Thank
your time.
You too. Thank
very
you
very much for being here. And she is very calm for considering what she has to do every day. Okay, when we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane. Her take on having a woman CEO behind the steering wheel at General Motors, plus the pitfalls and payoffs that come with self-doubt. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Become a WGBH sustainer and help every WGBH radio and television station go fundraiser-free this February. That's no mean feat. Sustainers break their gifts into monthly installments that automatically renew, and every sustainer helps steal away hours of on-air fundraising. Don't grinch out. Take WGBH's Sustainer Challenge by the end of the year, and you'll feel like your heart grew three sizes that day. Online at WGBHnews.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Fox Hill Village of Westwood, providing retirement living to active seniors for over 20 years, which now includes White Oak Cottages and its new concept in memory care. FoxHillVillage.com, WhiteOakCottages.com. And Father Brown, return to the 1950s, where a Catholic priest turns to his razor-sharp intellect to solve crimes in his quiet English village. Watch Father Brown Tuesday at 8 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Earlier today, General Motors named Mary Barra as its first female CEO, a serious feat in the male-dominated auto industry. So the question is Mary Barra the Danica Patrick of CEOs, or is Danica Patrick the Mary Barra of NASCAR? Joining us for her thoughts on this, among other things, is Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where, as you know, she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Hello there, Nancy.
Hey there.
So what do you think about this woman running GM? I think it's pretty exciting.
I think it's tremendous.
Yeah.
First ever, correct?
It's swell, as one of my editors used to say. It's wonderful. And it's just another kind of, you know, it's another great gauntlet dropped on previously, you know, it's virgin territory. There is no, has never been the CEO of an auto company, right? GM was for many, many years the largest corporation in the world. Let's just get some basic numbers. Last year, $152 billion of revenue, $6 billion in change in net income, right? 215,000 part and full-time employees around the world.
Wow.
This is a big battleship that this woman, a 30-year veteran,
yes,
right, you know, did her internship out of college, Kettering University, kind of a real kind of, you know, feeder school for GM. Father's a die maker at General Motors for a long time.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's
good. 30 years. She has held some amazingly complicated and important positions. She has been the vice president of global human resources, so she knows the game in terms of people. And then she was promoted to executive vice president of the global product development. That's like R&D at a tech factory, right, or a tech company. And they added on to her title not so long ago. They gave her supply chain and purchasing. So global supply chain and purchasing. So she knows her way around this ship very, very well. And it's just tremendously exciting. It's like, you know, Ginny Romedy at IBM, or, you know, Melissa Mayer at Yahoo, or Meg Whitman at IBM, or what's Ursula Burns at Xerox. It's like another woman on what was traditionally male turf going to make her mark. It's a new moment. It's a new day. It's exciting.
Well, you know what I found particularly exciting about it, too? I remember reading in the Wall Street Journal, this is a while ago, 10 or 15 years ago, that they looked at women that were running companies in America, and many of them had no kids, and she's got two exactly. She's a mother, she's a wife, and so she managed obviously to rise through the ranks of GM. She's also an electrical engineer, so she's got that that side of her brain working really well. But in a way that many other women couldn't.
Yeah, but did you read the New York Times story on her ascension?
What?
She couldn't remember her kids' names. Did you remember? No, I'm only kidding.
Say that. But you know, it is unusual.
You know, and she's been in the company 33 years. So
yes.
You think about the end of the traditional social contract, right? This is a woman who's worked her way, an individual who's worked her way up the ranks.
Which is so great.
It's just great.
Yeah.
And it's exciting. And, you know, it's going to happen real fast, right? She's slated to take over in the middle of January, right, from the outgoing CEO, Dan Akerson, who's leaving early, partly because his wife is very, very ill. So it's exciting. It's the new. It's part of an undeniable, you know, unstoppable wave of transition that is not about men losing and women gaining. It's about a new, much more diverse and much more variegated landscape of leadership.
Speaking of leadership, and I know there's a huge level of excitement in some quarters, and I'm sure there are a lot of people gunning for this woman. On the other hand, how have, as an historian, Nancy Kane, how have women who were the first in an industry to run a company, what's the track record of how they've done? The first in the computer world, the first in the whatever, particularly male-dominated industries like auto, I guess, is what I'm asking. How have they done?
So, you know, it's something of a sad fact that we don't have that much evidence. So I got online this morning and looked up, just for example, how many women CEOs there are in the Fortune 500.
Let's guess. Before you, I would
guess,
say
take a guess.
25 out of 500. What would you say, Marjorie? I don't know. I'm guessing.
I'll be optimistic and say 75.
Yeah, so it's close. In the Fortune 500, it's like 21 or 22.
Oh,
so
gosh.
It's 4% or something like that, right? 5%. So let's just be honest. We don't have, you know, volumes and volumes of data on this because it's relatively new that women have walked into positions traditionally held by men or solely held by men, as in the case of GM and the auto industry. And so we can say, well, here, let's run a regression on it. We don't have that kind of data. But you think about people, anecdotal, qualitative data. You think about people like Anne Mullally at Xerox. She did a tremendous job, right? You think about what Meg Whitman's trying to do now, what she did at eBay. At eBay first, right, and now what she's trying to do in a bigger company that's struggling much more significantly than eBay ever did. You think about people like
She ran for against Jerry Brown in between. Ran for governor, right?
And then she went to Hewlett Packard with huge, right, huge, if you will, roadblocks in front of her in terms of where the company was competitively and internally. Let's remember that there were some dubious issues around CEO or potentially dubious issues around CEO performance, right, offline that brought her to the board's search for a new CEO. Melissa Mayer, I think, seems to be unafraid and going great guns.
Yeah. She's really amazing because she's so young.
You know, I think Sheryl Sandberg is someone that a lot of people point to in the relatively, you know, male-dominated landscape of Facebook. You know, she's not the CEO. She's the chief operating officer. But there's no question that the force of her personality and knowledge and set of connections and breadth of vision has been a big, big deal. I'd suggest to you they could never have gone public without someone of her, if you will, stature, evolving stature, because she's a work in progress like all of us. I don't know anything about Marilyn Hewson at Lockheed Martin, but the last time I looked at the performance of that company within the last 6 months, it was ticking along. So again, we're talking about stories rather than data set, computerized data sets.
Okay, well, let's look at something where I don't know if there's data yet, but at some point there will be. I had off one night last week. I had the misfortune to turn on Crossfire with people screaming at each other on CNN. And the thing they were screaming at each other about was now that the United States was about to divest itself, which it did, I guess, in the last 24 hours, of any stock in GM,
yep.
$50 billion investment, give or take a few bucks. Yep. I think the United States people lost $10 billion or something like that, kept the company afloat. This screaming was whether it was a useful exercise of expenditures by the American government or was it not. I know it's early on. What's your take on whether or not the American government did the right thing?
My take is they did the right thing. I'm not sure we can measure it solely by kind of net financial loss or gain. First of all, there were a lot of jobs that were saved. I mean, the upper bound on those estimates is 1 million jobs. That seems to me, by bailing out the entire auto industry, that seems to me probably pretty high. But let's say several hundred thousand. That's an enormous number of jobs regionally concentrated in this case, and huge reverb, right, on the negative side to those jobs being lost. I think there's something else that's even more important, though. And that is, and it goes back to, you know, the government kind of pulling out its big glove and putting on a big handprint on the economy as it has it on many, many occasions under presidents of both parties over the last 70 years, you know, most notably, say, with FDR, is that when the government acts, and Paul Krugman is never tired of saying this, right, because he beats this horse, right, every single day with great passion, or every single time he writes a column in the New York Times, when government acts to shore up an industry or a company that is a flagship player in an industry, it affects immediately what Keynes, I've said, used this term before on the show, called animal spirits, the idea about what is going to happen next. So sometimes what the government was doing, and I think this was very true of Obama in 2009, and this is where I speak from, what the government is doing is saying, look, we're not going to let what was once the centerpiece of the American industrialized economy and the middle class, by the way, remember how many, you know, middle class jobs and possibilities and pensions were created in Detroit between 1910 and 1960. We're not going to let...
Just with auto workers, but suppliers.
Oh my God! Think of all the tier one, tier two, tier three. We're talking about millions of jobs, a whole region, right, of the economy, and all the reverb from that, and industries like steel that were dependent on this core industry. So when Obama steps in and says we're not going to let these guys fail, even though they were arrogant enough and, you know, narrow sighted enough to fly in and ask for bailouts. Ford didn't do this.
Right.
Remember, important to keep this in mind. GM and Chrysler flew in the private jets and said, give us
That's
more
right.
money. Remember
That's
how ridiculous
right.
that was?
Yeah. I've forgotten
right?
that.
So when Obama, you know, said we will bail these in, he was saying the government is committed to keeping the floorboards the foundation, the concrete foundation of the economy, of which GM and Chrysler are an important block, in place. So that has all kinds of effects on what the investors, employees, consumers, women that are controlling the family pocketbook think about both what might happen and how the worst thoughts and fears, which are very important animal spirits in the crashing of a banking system or the crashing of a stock market, what it's putting those fears in some sense at bay, or it's dialing them down. That in itself may have been the most important thing that happened, i.e. what did not happen.
Well,
because people knew that the auto industry would not go belly up.
Well, speaking of not go belly, I don't want to belabor this, but just briefly, is your sense after the fact that had we not invested whatever, I don't know what the total was, I don't know, it was $49.5 billion, I think it was,
in
General Motors, would either of those companies not have survived, or just would have survived in a different, smaller form? What would have been the consequence of a non-investment by the federal government?
Again, so now we're playing the economist hypothetical game,
right? Exactly.
But I think that if you go back to early 2009, right? Late 2008, remember when like stores were empty?
Yes.
Right? Like department stores have become museums?
Yes. And everybody was sick to their stomach about the whole future of the country.
Exactly. I mean, just to recall, the stock market dropped more than 500 points on several days in late 2008, right? Unemployment was, you know, climbing into double digits in early 2009, right? You then say, okay, General Motors isn't sure it has enough cash to keep operating. Now, you play out the different kind of ramifications of that being a 36-point headline in the New York Times or USA Today. And I think, right, I think that we, that it's in, okay, so, and then a free marketer, right, says, you know, well, how about if it just survives through creative destruction in smaller form? Well, smaller form would be talking about, you know, the shell of this company and the same damage, roughly the same damage in terms of, you know, ideas about what might happen. People's, you know, level of confidence and level of fear in the economy would still have erupted if you're saying we're just going to let it die under market forces, right? So I think, I really, really think that we have to remember that we have almost like a biological system when we talk about the economy that is affected by wind and weather, and some of those currents are emotional. A lot of what's going on in the stock market every day is about emotion and waves and momentum. And the amazing thing is that that's not just isolated, you know, activity. It's not just about the cowboys and the traders and the very smart people, right, that play the game at the casino of capitalism all around the world. It's affecting every single one of us, or huge numbers of us, and every single person in the world is indirectly affected by that, because when the stock markets fall as much as they did, the bond or the stock markets, as they did in 2008, Iceland risks going belly up. New York cops have no more pension. London firefighters have no more salary, because the bonds that those salaries were being the coupons from which we'll be peeling off to pay salaries no longer have any value. This is a big deal. So, and I'm not just talking about the financial markets. I'm talking about lots of other things as well, but the financial markets are the easiest way to see this. So I think on balance, yes. Expensive, yes. But you have to measure that relative to what didn't happen and what did happen. And here we are, what, 4 years later?
Right.
Right? GM is profitable. They're sitting on, you know, $26 billion in cash. They're now going to probably pay dividends now that the government's out and they're allowed to do that. And they've just named a 33-year veteran, a woman who's held all kinds of hard positions, who seems eminently competent and decent.
She does. Just one question about this from me. Where does the bankruptcy of Detroit fit into all this?
So the bankruptcy of Detroit is about, it's about the sort of 12-round boxing match, right, that the world global car industry has been involved in which, on balance, you know, the kind of Muhammad Ali for 40 or 50 years of the boxing ring, which was the American auto industry, the big three, we call them, right?
That's right.
That says a lot about their former stature, right, has just taken a lot of punches and is bleeding at the jaw.
Okay.
Not out, not by any means out, but no longer, you know, floats like a butterfly, stings like a bee.
Now, Nancy Kane, as someone who spends a decent amount of her time when you're not doing what you do at Harvard Business School, namely dealing with training, giving advice to, and whatever other words one does with major executives, there's a great piece in the New York Times called The Dutch Elm Disease of Creative Minds, and it's about a guy who basically is talking about his profession, writing. But I want to read one line here. I want to ask you about whether or not the issue he raises in the writing community is an issue that you have to deal with in the corporate executive community. Self-doubt, this guy wrote as Mark O'Connell, it's called The Dutch Elm Disease of Creative Minds. Self-doubt, which is what this whole piece is about, like physical caution, is a useful prophylactic against serious error. But there's a point at which it starts being more a cause of problems than a prevention. He starts out this piece talking about, he goes to some computer 20-year-old tech fair, a web, whatever he calls, a web summit somewhere. And he said he's blown away by all these 20-somethings who exude nothing but 100% confidence.
Right.
He has self-doubt. One, should I be here? Two, should I pitch this story to begin with? And once my editor at the New York Times said, yes, I like it, I'm probably not the person to write. I mean, the guy is racked with self-doubt. But it raises larger issues about what is the appropriate balance in a leader in terms of doubting what he or she is about to do and having the confidence at the same time to ensure that they can go forward and make decisions that benefit the people that they're responsible to. How do you deal with that?
So I wish I had like a kind of, you know, PowerPoint deck on this. I actually got tenure about 10 years ago and stopped using any PowerPoint. So that's perhaps not saying very much. But I wish I could give you like, you know, the recipe, you know, one cup of self-doubt at this moment,
right,
you know, a pinch of self-confidence and detachment. I can't. My history doesn't allow us that kind of precision. But what I can say from my hands-on work and my historical research on leaders is, and as a writer, right, I live with self-doubt. It's, you know, it's right here, right? It's right hung over my shoulder with this, like, you know, Filene's basement handbag that
right.
I carry, right?
It's waving right
it's
now.
It's waving right now. How are you? Come over closer and let me spill some more of my elixir all over you, Nancy. So, I think all of us live with, you know, at times heavy buckets full of self-doubt. I think what distinguishes people that end up having a lot of worthy agency, I'm only interested in worthy impact. I have no time for those that have nothing, that aren't interested in advancing goodness and committing to it. I just don't. The world doesn't have time for it either, but that's another story. In any event, my own experience working with these people, watching them, studying them, wanting to be like them in some cases, is that like our writer here, Mark O'Connor, or like some of the people I talk about, we've talked about them before, there's a healthy slug of self-awareness that coexists with the self-doubt. So you can see it. This guy's writing about it, perhaps in overly lengthy terms, I might add, right? And you can see it, and then you decide, what does this purpose, does it serve for me? Because if it paralyzes you, right, or it keeps you, you know, utterly dependent on external gratification because you're not sure from the inside out that you're okay or what you're doing is okay or you're on the right path, then that is not the right, that is too much. That is, if you will, the buckets of self-doubt are too heavy. And I see that a lot in some of the people I work with. I see it in myself. I think one of the great, if you will, objectives of a life well lived is the reflection and self-awareness and commitment to work on oneself in relation to the right proportions of self-doubt. So, to make sense of that, let me give you a couple of examples. So you think about someone like Rachel Carson. She was both a writer and a leader, right? She wrote Silent Spring, yep, published in 1962, set the world on fire, started the whole runway to the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the environmental movement, the EPA. You know, it was a book that, you know, created, as the New Yorker said, a noisy summer, and then a noisy 10 years of reaction to it. She was someone who we know from her letters and her diaries and recorded conversations with people that was doubted her writing as she did it constantly. Have I done enough homework? Have I gotten the link between cancer and synthetic pesticides like DDT right? Right? Am I, and this every writer can relate to, every writer of any ilk, when am I going to finish this thing? Because it's taking at least three times longer than it should, right? Because, of course, writers never write until the pain of writing is greater than the pain of procrastinating.
Right. And so, it's painful.
And it's both are painful. And eventually scales tip and you start the really painful process of writing. So she doubted herself. And she doubted, and yet, what she did with that, and this is true of Lincoln, who doubted himself at a number of important junctures in the Civil War and despaired that the doubt came close to seeping over into despair, but never did quite. What they did, each of those people in different ways, was they kind of pulse-checked themselves. They said, I'm not sure about this. Let me go check, right? Let me write a few more letters, in the case of Carson, no email, letters to scientists I know that can help me corroborate this, right? Let me figure out a different way, because she was racked by illness and eye problems and all kinds of problems. Let me figure out a different way to sit up and have someone read my prose to me so I can correct it, right, orally. Oh, she was amazing. Real determination has to exist if you're to have the right recipe of using self-doubt to a good purpose.
She had eye problems?
Oh, my God. She had phlebitis. She had all kinds of things, right? And she's battling metastasizing breast cancer the whole way through. And she knew it. She knew very early on that this was going to be a fatal disease. In any case, persistence, endurance is part of the story, too. In any event, Lincoln did the same thing. Like, he would have one of his inevitable public opinion baths, bring some people in and listen to them, constituents or generals or other politicians, and get a pulse check on what he was questioning himself about. One of the things none of these people did, and I can tell you that I work with a lot of millennials, very accomplished, very serious, very ambitious, very, very focused, very driven millennials. They all have buckets of self-doubt. They may package it well, but they all have buckets of self-doubt.
But as an outsider, I should say, because it's funny you brought that up. I was going to ask you at the end of whatever you're about to say, the sense I get from outside as opposed to you inside of the millennials, of the 20 and 30-something masters of the universe, is they have decided the way to lead is exhibiting no self-doubt, even though people like me find self-doubt in a leader to be a actually charming, humanizing quality amongst the powerful. But most of them have decided never to exhibit to anybody.
Absolutely. So, they do on their Facebook pages, and I'm sure they do in texts, and I'm sure there are Instagram videos of people acting.
I mean, for us to see.
Right,
is what
right.
Mean.
So, right. But again, that the kind of hindsight and perspective that allows you to know when to hold them and when to display those cards as someone with some impact or with some eyes on mm-hmm. you comes with time. We can't import that. There is no iPhone app for, hey, when do I show my self-doubt and when don't I? When do I hide it all? I think sometimes, and I say this knowing myself very well, I think sometimes the harder we work to appear to be all zipped up and so confident, actually often the more self-doubting and to use a slightly different word, insecure, anxious we are about what we're actually doing. Last point about leaders, people of impact of all kinds, teachers, parents. You know, I always use the story of when I'm working with coaches, when I'm coaching leaders about you can't always have the luxury of being your truly authentic self. You have to know when to show your fears or your doubts or your anxiety. You have to know when the moment is right. And people look at me like, wait a minute, I need to be authentic. And I say, okay, You're a parent. It's a late on a rainy night. The rain is teeming down on 95, and you are driving, and you're far from your next destination, from the hotel that you've already registered in. And your kids are in the backseat, and they say, "Mommy, is everything okay?" Do you turn around and say, "No, actually, I'm really, really panicked. I can't quite see the middle line, and the guys are going really fast, and they're spying." And the semi is, "No, you don't say that. You say, everything is fine, dear."
Yeah, that's right.
So that's the right analogy. You have to know with experience, with perspective, with some self-awareness, and with the ability to step outside yourself and say, is this the right time to reveal this? Is this the right group of people? Is this the right set of stakeholders? So I think self-doubt is very, very valuable, like so many of, you know, if you will, the emotional experiences and tools that we have. It has to be used with great consciousness and some integrity and some real attention to, is this serving the higher road purpose that I know I want to advance?
So when the late Steve Jobs is out there on the stage introducing his new products, and maybe some of them were better than other products, was he doing a good sales job even though he was thinking to himself, oh, my God, this isn't really what I hoped it would be? So
he was a pretty tightly zipped up person in terms of his emotions. He was also maniacally focused on detail. So this is someone who didn't want anything to go wrong. So if you read, you know, what's out there in the public domain about getting ready for the Mac show, right?
Yep.
Or for one of these big unveilings, the iPhone, you know both how incredibly carefully he had thought out the potential, right, you know, black holes, if you will, or stumbles in that presentation. You know how passionate he was about getting it right. And you know at some very, very important level that his way of putting to rest his doubts about what might happen and how much he cared was like a lawyer to make sure that all the mistakes that might happen or bad things that might occur didn't. So there's someone who I think probably used, at least in the public realm, his own doubts or, you know, what if questions, that little voice, use them very, very effectively.
Okay, Nancy Kane, before you go, speaking of self-doubt, I am holding up something. I would like you to tell the people listening, what am I holding in my left hand, please?
So you're holding up a homemade Oreo.
By whom? Whose home?
By my home.
Oh,
by
my
whom?
God.
Made by whom?
Made by the little elfin hands in my kitchen.
Of Nancy Kane. Now, are you experiencing self-doubt? You told us when you walked in, it's the first time you've ever made Oreos. You bring us cookies almost every week.
I hope it's really good. I haven't tasted them.
You haven't tasted your own Oreo?
No, here's the thing. So I make cookies, as you know, and I have...
I'm going to taste them while you're talking.
Okay, you take it. So I love... it's a long a story for our listeners, but I believe that the world needs more softness and love. And in my small way, I think handing out homemade cookies is
Look
part
at Marjorie.
Of that. So this is an invention of a very dear person in my life named Lee, who said homemade Oreos should be those lovely little black wafers that you often put in like mint, cream de menthe pies and sugared cream in the center. So those just came out of the icebox because those don't keep long.
Okay, let me say something.
Quick review, Marjorie.
That's my lovin' for the day.
I am a double stuffed Oreo.
So those are good for you, right?
I love double stuffed Oreos.
So what's the verdict?
These are spectacular.
Spectacular.
And the cream is about a million times better than what you're ever going to get in any store-bought Oreo.
Right.
So, these are superb.
So erase that self-doubt, Nancy Kane.
Yeah, well,
just
thank you. I feel much relieved. If you could just come to me and sit on my shoulder while I finish this chapter, I would be...
Before you go, I mean, if you are not familiar with Nancy, who joins us every single Tuesday, she is working a book on about some of the great leaders of all time. What's the latest timetable? I don't want to make you anxious.
So I'm late. I hope to have everything to my very, very fine and talented and insightful and patient editor, Nikki, at Penguin, before the end of January. It will come in about 2.5 months.
And so theoretically, when do we end up reading this?
In September.
Great.
Okay.
Nancy Kane, it's great to see you. You're a great soul and you're a great baker as well.
Have no self-doubt about your cooking abilities.
God.
I mean, these are superb.
Or anything else for that matter.
Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration, and she joins us every Tuesday for Open Mic and cookies. Thank you very much.
Marjorie's got one
Nancy.
Cookie in one hand as she's holding the script, I should say.
When we come back, we're going to ask you what happens when the value of your house shrinks by half because the government decided it should. It's happening in Brookline, and it could also happen in your backyard. This conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
It's fun.
This week, WGBH News has a week of focus coverage on the search for Alzheimer's treatments.
Alzheimer's will single-handedly crush our healthcare system in the next 10 years if we don't do something. That's not a guess or a prediction, that's a reality.
I'm reporter Sean Corcoran. Join us for Desperate for a Cure, focus coverage on the search for new Alzheimer's treatments. Tonight on WGBH2's Greater Boston.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and AAA Southern New England, helping and serving members for more than 110 years with roadside assistance, insurance and financial products, and a full-service travel agency. Details at AAA.com. AAA, membership for life. And Russell's, a family tradition for over 135 years with Christmas trees, roping, lights, gift, toy, and flower shops, plus live animals. Russell's Garden Center, Route 20 in Wayland. For evening hours, you can visit russellsgardencenter.com.
Both trying to digest Nancy Kane's Oreos before we speak. They're incredible. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So imagine you come home from work. You're sorting through your mail, expecting a holiday card or two, something like that. But instead you get a letter from the government, which essentially says your house is worth half of what you paid for it. Well, it's happening in Brookline. If you read Marjorie's column this morning in the Herald, it could happen in other towns. In an effort to tighten residency rules in an overcrowded, desirable school system, the school committee in Brookline is targeting households on the Brookline-Boston line, telling them the Brookline school system is off limits. And the questions are, isn't there a better way to deal with an overcrowded school system? Should the school committee be bullying its own constituents? And can you fight city, or in this case, town hall? 877-301-8970. And by the way, this is not just a Brookline story. What's the name of the writer below you, Chris Cassidy?
Chris Cassidy, Linfield, Lexington, other towns.
Well, it's also happened on the Cambridge-Somerville line about houses that straddle lines. And we should say in this case, these homeowners, from what I read in your column, Marjorie, had gotten letters when they purchased the house saying you're in Brookline.
Right.
We're paying Brookline property taxes, which are pretty high.
Oh, they're huge.
And then they're all of a sudden being told you can't send your kid, which is the primary reason you moved here to begin with, to a Brookline school.
This woman that I talked to last night, her picture's in the paper, Liz Donovan, her husband Brendan. Brendan does crossword puzzles, by the way, for different publications.
Oh, anyway, it's my dream, by the way.
They saved every last penny for the last several years to move into Brookline, where housing is very expensive because of the schools, and they bought this third floor, a tiny two room apartment in a three family, not exactly a luxurious place, but they did it because they wanted to send their kid to the Brookline public schools. And she told me that when they bought the house, like 12 other people were competing with them because they wanted the house, and it's very
for the same reason
for the same reason, right? And it's on the Brookline Brighton line. They're very happy. They're there. Their kid can walk down the street to school. Then they find out 6 months later they get this letter in the mail saying, "Sorry, we're thinking that because the schools are overcrowded, your kid is not going to be able to go to the Brookline schools. So see you later." They have a 2-year-old who isn't in the schools. I should say that if the kids are already in the schools, they're allowing you to grandfather your child in. But the issue is, if you sell your house, as many people do, and down the road, you're not going to make any money on the house after you made this huge investment because you're not able to take advantage of the Brookline schools. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. It's a bait and switch.
Yeah, but and the moral is, I don't mean this at all in an unkind, I don't really care about the situation in Brookline, even though I hope those people all get to send their kids there because they relied on representations. The story for me has a moral to it. We just heard Rachel Caprillion here, the Registrar of Motor Vehicles, who's talking about trying to deal with every customer to the best of her ability, with kindness, respect, warmth, trying to solve their problems. This is sort of the ultimate flipping the bird at the people who are essentially helping to support the town. And the notion that a government could crassly send a letter. I know what some of you are going to say. A lot of people with health plans got the exact same kind of letter. And I think there's sadly, some merit to this. But this is a moderate-sized town in Massachusetts. And what I took away from your story, Marjorie, in the companion piece by Chris Cassidy,
is this is no way to run a railroad. Oh. And by the way, if you care, this happens in lots of communities. They have something called the pillow rule. I don't want to bore you with it.
Yeah, but where your head rests at
where
night.
The kid's head rests, essentially, if you have a child. Forget that. There's no applicability here. This is a situation where they got letters saying you're a resident of Brookline. They pay Brookline taxes. And because everybody wants to be in the Brookline schools, they now tell these people, essentially, what they're saying is sue us, even though they aren't saying those words. 877-301-89. What's your takeaway from this sort of story? Have you had an interaction with your town or city government where they just showed no concern for you as a human?
Well,
that's what this story is about.
You know what drives me crazy, particularly about this story, is that, you know, Brookline, people in Brookline, and I've lived there for a long time, we think of ourselves as very right-thinking and compassionate people. We do the right thing. You know, the town meeting passed this thing. They couldn't enforce it because it was unenforceable. They said they didn't approve of spanking, and everybody thought that was great. And they just banned plastic bags for environmental reasons and styrofoam, and we're a sanctuary city for illegal immigrants so they can come to Brookline, not to worry
great
about anybody going after them.
So they
do all these wonderful things in the interest of compassion, and they shaft these poor people that have put every last dime into it. And they're not high rollers. I mean, these people are, you know, working people who've saved and saved and saved to get these little tiny condos. And one of them joked, Thea Singer, who joked that she's the smallest, tiniest house in all of Brookline, this little tiny place. They shaft these people. Now,
By the way, if people are not familiar with this, I have a lot of friends in Cambridge, too, where the school system is not quite what it is in Brookline, who moved there from Boston, for example, who have lived since their kids were infants or before they had kids in these – practically in these closets. And the reason they do it is that they suffer because they know their kid's going to get a better education. And it is, and everybody on the Brookline School Committee, the chair I had worked with many, many years ago when he was at U.S. Trust, who's a very decent guy, Alan Morse, haven't seen him in 20 or some years. It's unbelievable to me. This is how you deal somebody who's a constituent and a fellow human being. In any case,
877-301-8970. What do you think of this? 877-301-8970. Gene in Belmont, you are first on the Brookline cracking down on the border.
Hey, Gene.
Is that what you need money for?
Oh, hey, Gene, are you talking to us or somebody else?
How much is that?
Oh, Gene's ordering in the can I have a French vanilla milk, no sugar, Gene, and you deliver it to One Guest Street. Gene,
I'd be happy to. I'm making Christmas cookies right now.
Oh, we love that. What's up?
Listen, I live here in Belmont.
Yeah.
And about 30, just a story, this rings true, the story you're talking about, Brookline. Here in Belmont, about 30 years ago, a family lived in a two-family. They owned the two-family, and I think it was a side-by-side, if I can remember correctly.
Oh, that was the Romneys, correct, Gene? Is that I'm sorry. I'm only kidding. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. right. Opposite side of town. So their kids did go to the local school, which they could walk to. And I think, now we're talking 1982-ish, and these kids, a couple of them might have been in special needs back in those days. They were separate, they're blah, 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 extra funds. This family, so they paid taxes in Belmont. Their phone number was Belmont.
Yep.
They believed they lived in Belmont. They sent their kids they were told they could not send their kids to the Butler School, which was the neighborhood school, because their whole house wasn't in Belmont, and that the law they used, and I've checked this out with a couple of other people, it was where you literally hang your hat determines where you live.
Well, Gene, we weren't kidding about the pillow rule. The pillow rule is literally used in many of these situations. It's where the head of your child. So you may have to move the bed in the bedroom. I'm serious.
Exactly.
But the difference.
Pick up the whole house and move it 7 feet to the left or to the right.
The difference, as ridiculous as those rules sound, including the hat hanging thing, if it turns out you have no assurance at the beginning of the game, there's got to be some rule, as long as it's not insanely unfair. The reason this Brookline thing sticks out like a sore thumb, as I've said now four times, these people had assurances from the town that they were in Brookline.
In Boston.
They had assurances.
On town stationery.
They were happy to take their taxes in Brookline at an elevated rate, but they're not happy to have their kids go to the school. So what happened? What's the end of the story, Jane?
Well, they moved. They sold their house.
They moved.
They
oh
moved
my
to
God.
Brookline, and they can't get in those schools either.
Yeah.
Hey, Gene, thank you for the call. It's a bad connection. Thank you.
I should point out that this is a proposal from the school committee. It hasn't happened yet, and we're hoping that cooler heads prevail and this does not happen. But that's the proposal, and people are hysterical about it, needless to say, who are affected by this. Let's go to Dave in Lexington. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi, Dave.
Thanks for having me. This is outrageous. You know, if you pay the property taxes, you should get the school system. And the property taxes are huge, and it's just absolutely crazy, and I hope you make them squirm. I do have to say, though, that you're missing another point.
What?
Which is that when you say Brookline is compassionate, they are a sanctuary city. Well, that looks compassionate on the surface, but if you dig down, that's not at all compassionate. For every illegal immigrant who is here and whose presence here is aided and abetted by various governments, both local and state, there is an American who is getting screwed.
Well, you know, David, I hear you. We're not going to have a debate about illegal immigration today. And I would say that many businesses in this country, many Republicans and Democrats, based upon what action they're proposing in Congress, would not agree with you. But, David, thank you for the call. You know, Derek's going to bring up a case that is a little bit different that I had totally forgotten about, that is a one that had headlines, which is a variation on a theme. Derek in a car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up, Derek?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great. Remind us of the story. This is an incredible story.
Okay. It is. And I actually brought it up on my wife's phone just so I had the facts right. 34-year-old single mother arrested and doing a 5-year jail sentence for using her babysitter's address to send her child to a better school system.
This is in, was this outside, was this Bridgeport or somewhere? Where was this in Connecticut?
I think it's in, hold on, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And she sent the child to Norwalk, Connecticut.
Yeah. And what the story is, let me just, is a little bit of the backstory that Derek, essentially, there's no question that she, there, unlike the Brookline thing, the woman broke the rules, but she broke the rules and probably broke the law only out of concern for her child.
Kids.
She wanted the child to have a chance at a better education, but technically she was not entitled to send her child there for the reasons that you, I didn't realize, she's doing five years in jail?
5 years. The state has accused her of stealing $15,000 worth of education from the city of Norwalk.
Boy, you know, that drives me crazy. There was a great
Derek,
story somewhere.
Yesterday
I read somewhere, and you may have read it too, Jim, talking about there's an arrestable class and there's a non-arrestable class. And the non-arrestable class are the Wall Street titans of industry that stole billions and billions of dollars from people and ruined people's retirement and stuff like that. And the arrestable class is the poor single mother who is trying – did the wrong thing. Yes, she did do the wrong thing, but she did it for what you might say would be a noble reason to try to get her kid a good education. So there you go. It's not, we're going to hell in a handbasket.
We are?
Yes, we are.
Not on this show. By the way, you should read Marjorie's great column, Battle Brews in Brookline, is the heading in today's Boston Herald. What's coming up?
When we come back, bird expert Vern Lux joins us to talk about the plight and flight of the snowy owl. We'll find out why Logan Airport is the favorite destination for these birds. That and more on bird watching coming up in 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
An end to poverty from the mouths of babes.
I will give people presents, like kids who don't get presents with my own money out of my pocket.
An 11-year-old named Dasani who lives in poverty in New York City, where the New York Times says the number of homeless children is higher than at any time since the Great Depression. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Northeastern University, where faculty, students, and alumni turn innovative ideas into solutions, and solutions into economic growth and prosperity. Northeastern is proud to support Innovation Hub on WGBH, Saturday at 10 a.m. And the Museum of Science, where you can step inside the Hall of Human Life and exhibit you and discover how everyday human behavior affects our brains, our bodies, and the world around us. Details at mos.org/exhibityou.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Earlier today, Vern Lux said that the snowy owl would have been the number one headline if there hadn't been something a little more pressing, as we all would agree, as in Nelson Mandela's memorial service. He's here with us to explain why. And before he does, we should tell you his credentials. Vern is the senior naturalist for the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. He writes a weekly birding column for the Cape Cod Times. He's a contributor to our sister stations, WCAI and WNAN. And most importantly, he is taking me and Marjorie birding come spring.
That's right.
Vern, it's great to talk to you again.
How are you?
Oh, we're excellent.
Great. And thank you for talking to us today, Vern. So what would have been this headline had not we been distracted?
Oh, my goodness. Well, we're having perfect snowy owl weather down here on Nantucket right now, which is I'm on Nantucket, and we're having whiteout conditions.
Wow.
Over the weekend, my favorite city, the home of the New York dreaded Yankees, at the Port Authority at Kennedy Airport, they had a we've had an incredible eruption, it's called, almost an incursion of snowy owls from the far north. And they've showed up anyway.
Wait, before you go ahead, it's not eruption. I had never heard this word before. It's eruption, I-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N. What does that mean, Vern?
Correct. Well, I mean, it could just mean an incursion. It means that any bird, especially snowy owls that live in the Arctic, are subject to a very cyclic food supply. They're basically in years when there's lots of lemmings, these small rodents that just get super abundant up there. All the snowy owls raise 6 or 8 young. And then periodically these lemming populations will crash and the birds basically either have to move or starve. So it looks like birds from Greenland and the eastern Canadian Arctic this year, there weren't any coming around in October, November. I was out of the country for a couple weeks and I came back and all of a sudden, we're just inundated with snowy owls.
Okay, so I interrupted you. Tell us what happened at the airport in New York City that is pretty frightening.
Well, you're right. The Port Authority, they had an incident with of course, they're not used to snowy owls there. It's a very rare occurrence. This year, snowy owls have just erupted, and they're all over the place. Pretty much any beach and all the airports have them. And they had one apparently fly into an engine on a parked airplane. And then they issued a kill order, and over last weekend they shot two, or it appears 3 snowy owls were gunned down at Kennedy Airport, which caused an absolute, they leaked the word to some bird watchers, who then got it out to the New York press, and a petition was started, and within 6 hours, 3,200 signatures were gathered, but the whole thing is, it's just completely unnecessary. Of course, everyone's for safety, and I can understand how the miracle on the Hudson there, that plane left Kennedy Airport, ran into a flock of geese, so they're more sensitive. But Massport is the light years ahead of New York. They've had a snowy owl, quote-unquote, problem. The owls live up in the Arctic, and when they come south, places like Logan, in fact, Logan Airport turns out to be like the number one favorite spot for snowy owls in North America.
Yeah, why? Stop there for a second. Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was hyperbole in your column. That's true?
No, it's not. There's a gentleman named Norman Smith. He runs the Trailside Museum for Mass Audubon. He's an incredible bander, very knowledgeable guy. He's been banding and he's been trapping owls off the runways at Logan since 1981. And he captures them. They put a trap out with either a mouse or a bird, and the owl flies over and gets tangled up. They capture it.
Oops. Vern, say that again. Vern, we lost you for a second. Bad connection. Say what you're about to say again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. You mentioned this guy that was capturing them with either a mouse or a bird, but then continue from there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Norman captures them. They do. Sometimes in the past, they've put satellite transmitters on the birds. We actually know where they go back to in the Arctic and have had them return. But then they remove them. They bring them either up to Plum Island or down to Duxbury Beach, and they take them away from the airport and hopefully avoiding collisions, you know, with aircraft. This year, they've already trapped 20 birds at Logan, and just 2 days ago, apparently there were another 14 owls that have come in and are sitting around. Logan looks just like where they live, although there's lots of food, and they don't recognize the jets or the airplanes as any kind of threat. And it really is a problem. This year, 2 owls have run into jets at Logan and been killed. but they were not hit into the engine intake. So it's a problem for everybody. But snowy owls are this incredible. They're almost like a magical bird.
They're in Harry Potter.
Hey, Vern.
They are.
Vern, two quick things about snowy owls. In a minute, I want to ask you where we could see them in nature. But even if it's at Logan Airport, which is sort of weird to me.
You don't want to go there.
But why does Logan know how to do it without killing them, and the Port Authority in New York at Kennedy Airport thinks you do have to kill them? What are they missing there?
Well, because of Norman Smith, I'd say, and Mass Audubon's relationship with the Port Authority, you know, they knew it was these birds are quite rare, and they're very special, and there is no reason, you know, if they become a problem on the runways, then let's try a non-lethal action, and trapping them worked rather well. Norm's been out there, but New York had no experience. They rarely get snowy owls. And their first reaction in any kind of airport thing is to go ahead and shoot them.
Hey, so where can one see a snowy owl if one would like to?
Well, this is the mother of all years to see a snowy owl. And if you even make a half-hearted attempt to see a snowy owl, I am quite confident that you'll be able to see one.
Where do you go?
A gentleman last week started at Cape Ann, and he went up to Salisbury on the New Hampshire border. With a spotting scope, although he's a very experienced birder, he found 21 snowy owls afternoon.
Oh,
wow.
21. On Nantucket last Wednesday, Edie Ray was here by herself. She found 11 snowy owls. There are snowy owls being reported from pretty much every beach I can think of, on the South Shore, the North Shore. They're all over the Cape on all island towns. There's two at the Worcester Airport. So if you, Newburyport and Plum Island are probably the best place.
Hey, Vern, before you go, you're to engage in a Christmas bird count this season. Tell us what the deal is with that and what's the purpose. Give us the whole deal.
Every year from December 14th to January 5th, they run what's called the Christmas bird counts. They were started some 111 years ago. Because it used to be traditional for sportsmen, quote-unquote, to go out and have a Christmas Day hunt, and they'd pretty much shoot everything they saw and see who could get the most. Well, a gentleman said, you know, wouldn't it be great not to kill everything? And they started watching birds, and now these Christmas counts have grown to a huge event all over North America and beyond. And what happens is you go out for a 24-hour period, you pick a day, and you try to count every single bird of every species in a 15-mile diameter circle, which is mission impossible. Of course, you're never going to count every bird, but you try. And it's fun. There's a Christmas count in Boston. This weekend, I'll be participating in the Buzzards Bay count, which is on the 14th. The circle is like in North Falmouth. It includes Buzzards Bay, Marion. The next day is the Outer Cape count, which is also, I believe, the Boston count is that day. If people are interested, there's a website called massbird.org, massbird.org, and they click on that, and they'll give you a listing to every Christmas bird count in Massachusetts and elsewhere in New England.
And can real people, not that you're not a real person, Vern Locks.
He's not a real person.
But Vern,
that's the nice thing anyone said to me.
I mean that in a totally loving way, Vern. Hey, Vern, can real people who are not experienced birders, I'm looking at Marjorie and myself in this case, even though we will be after we go out with you in the spring, can real people actually participate in the count, or they can just watch what's going on?
I went on my first Christmas count when I was in the 8th grade. No one starts out as an expert. Everybody starts as a beginner. And the beauty of a Christmas count is you'll have people from all walks of life. I mean, birding cuts through not only generational stuff, but doctors, lawyers, dentists, painters, janitors, everybody watches birds. And you get to meet people with a like-minded interest. You get to go outside and enjoy some fresh air. It's really a wonderful thing, and I would recommend it to anyone.
Vern, we only have a few seconds left, but I wonder, to get back to the airport for just a second, why doesn't the noise bother these owls, the jets taking off? It's so loud.
I know. No one really knows. They just, It's a good question. Why doesn't it bother them? But I think what's happening is a lot of these owls are coming south, and they're at altitude. They could be up to 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 feet in the air.
Yep.
And they look down, and they see the runways, and it's like it looks like home. And they drop down onto the runways, and there's lots of food. I know over the years they've seen great horned owls, snowy owls, which are the heaviest owl in North America by quite a bit. They've seen them capture, go up in the air and actually attack and kill rough-legged hawk.
Oh, wow.
Herons, yeah. Because they live and nest in the Arctic, unlike other owls, these things have to hunt in the daytime. And the stuff can see them coming. So they've developed, their wings are more like a falcon than an owl. They're really unique in so many ways.
So Vern, are you, Vern.
We're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us.
You're great, Vern.
It's great
Thanks.
To talk to you. Oh. Vern Locks is the senior naturalist for the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. He writes a weekly birding column for the Cape Cod Times, and he's a contributor to our sister stations, WCAI and WNAN. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Bright. Charlie Baker will be with us tomorrow, as will Brian McGrory.
Yep, and please tune in.